is, in a clear sense, a meta subject. That is, I'm going to raise the question, in what sense is the kind of theory that I've been putting forward scientific? Can it be considered to be part of science? I think this sort of meta question makes perfectly good sense, and it doesn't offend Barry Stroud's strictures against trying to go outside all of our thought and so forth. This is very much from within. I thought I liked Barry's remarks very much, and especially his attempt to say what can't be said. That is, why it is that it doesn't make any sense to try to find a standpoint outside of our standpoints from which to criticize, comment on, make reassuring statements, and so forth. I think with respect to that kind of remark, and one's about skepticism quite generally, it is in general a good idea in philosophy just not to make that kind of statement about one's own work. But there's no reason somebody else can't do it. Barry is in a perfectly good position to comment on everything that I've said, what the point of view is that's represented, what can and can't be done from that point of view. That's all fine. But I'm barred from doing the same thing for obvious reasons. I'm glad to have it put that way, because I actually feel a certain amount of resistance to trying to say too much about what I'm up to. That is, I have certain problems which I'm able to state from my own point of view and try to solve within the resources that I have. Further philosophical remarks about how this is related to skepticism are in a way bound to go wrong. I like that. These remarks are partly reactions that I've been expressing to other people about why it is that I myself resist labeling my own position in one way or another. Let others do it if they enjoy it, but it's not for me to do this. So I've been pulling my neck in over the years. And where I used to feel quite free, for example, to say that my view about events, this was synthetic a priori work, I now say, why say that? Everybody's going to put their own interpretation on that and get it wrong. You can see what's going on. You can see what the arguments for it are, what the results of it are. You can put a label on it if you feel like it. I wish I could restrict myself. I wish I could learn the lesson that I'm stating here and apply it to myself consistently. But at least in recent years, I've stopped calling myself a realist. I'm sure I'm not an anti-realist. Good, there go a couple of things. I think there's a clear sense in which what I'm saying doesn't fit the certain standard patterns of what I would call empiricism. So I'm not an empiricist. I'm not an idealist. I'm not a scientist what do I mean by that? Forget that. I don't believe any longer in using the words coherence theory of truth or correspondence theory of truth for my own views. And I don't want a name for what it is I'm doing. I just want to do it as well as I can and let others decide what its significance, if any, is. All right, well, here's some stuff on the relationship between psychology and philosophy. Many philosophers have doubted whether psychology can be made a serious science. Wittgenstein writes, and I'm sure you've all read this, the confusion and barrenness of psychology is not to be explained by calling it a young science. Its state is not comparable with that of physics, for instance, in its beginnings. For in psychology, there are experimental methods and conceptual confusion. I'm still quoting, the existence of experimental methods makes us think that we have the means of solving the problems which trouble us, though problem and methods pass one another by. That's the quotation from Wittgenstein. I take this to apply, not just, I mean, meant to apply by Wittgenstein, not just to psychology as it existed when he wrote, but to be a judgment sub specie eternitatis. Gilbert Ryle seems to have been of the same mind. When it comes to explaining human behavior, it's pretentious, he thinks, to hope to do better than common sense. And I quote from Ryle, when we hear the promise of a new scientific explanation of what we say and do, we expect to hear of some counterparts to those impacts, like those of which physics treats, some forces or agencies of which we should never have dreamed and which we shall certainly never witness at their subterranean work. But when we're in a less impressionable frame of mind, we find something implausible in the promise of discoveries yet to be made of the hidden causes of our own actions and reactions. We know quite well what caused the farmer to return from the market with his pigs unsold. He found the prices were lower than he had expected. We know quite well why John Doe scowled and slammed the door. He had been insulted. That's Ryle. Now, where Wittgenstein and Ryle are contemptuous of the idea of a serious science that aims to explain human behavior, Quine exhibits a certain ambivalence about the possibility of such a science, and this ambivalence seems to me to be more common today. Does Quine think that the concepts of meaning, communication, interpretation, belief, and so on can be worked into a serious science of behavior? Given the attention that Quine has paid to the understanding of language and his view that philosophy is continuous with science, you might think that Quine would say yes. And as I'll show in a minute, there is some reason to think that this is Quine's answer. But there are also some passages that I can quote that do make you think maybe that's not his answer. J.B. Watson, the originator of modern behaviorism, thought that concepts like those of belief and desire were, and I quote, heritages of a timid, savage past, or, quotes, medieval conceptions of a peace with magic and voodoo. B.F. Skinner, a longtime friend of Quine's, put it more mildly. I quote, the objection, he says, of such concepts as those of intention, belief, and desire, is not that these things are mental, but that they offer no real explanation and stand in the way of a more effective analysis. Watson speaks repeatedly of an alternative to mentalistic formulations and adds, I wouldn't be involved in this, that is, behavioristic psychology, if I did not think that mentalistic ways of thinking about human behavior stand in the way of much more effective ways. An anecdote I've often heard, I don't know for certain whether it's right, but we can easily find out, is that it was Quine who put Skinner onto Watson. He said, you're interested in behavior and all this. Well, why don't you read this man, Watson? Skinner read Watson, and his life was changed. The other half of this anecdote says, Skinner said to Quine, so you're interested in philosophy and so forth. I suggest that you take a look at language. True, false?
Both false.
Both false. Okay, good. Yeah. That's the way it goes with anecdotes. Quine seems to agree with Skinner and Watson, as his open endorsement of behaviorism suggests he would. All in all, Quine writes, the propositional attitudes are in a bad way. These are the idioms most stubbornly at variance with scientific patterns. That's the end of that quote. Much of the chapter of Word and Object that's titled Flight from Intention is directly against those who think we can talk freely of propositions and the propositional attitudes without asking for a basis in behavior. Of course, that's consistent with providing such a basis, that is, legitimizing these various concepts. But further remarks seem to put such a possibility in doubt. After accepting Brentano's claim that intentional idioms are not reducible to non-intentional concepts, Quine remarks, and there's a famous quotation, I mean, everybody quotes it, one may accept the Brentano thesis either as showing the indispensability of intentional idioms and the importance of an autonomous science of intention, or as showing the baselessness of intentional idioms and the emptiness of a science of intention. My attitude, Quine says, unlike Brentano's, is the second. Now, what perhaps should settle the matter, that last quotation maybe should settle the matter, but I'm not sure whether it does. For what, after all, is the status of Quine's attempt to give a behavioristic account of what is sound in translation? Quine does not attempt to reconstruct the concepts of meaning, analyticity, and the rest as philosophers have thought of them. But what he does provide is intended to make sense, not only of speakers, but of what they say. It does this by telling when a translation of the speaker's words is acceptable on behavioristic grounds. My question remains, is this enterprise merely the best we can do, but not even the beginning of a science? Or is it the direction we must take if we want to be scientific about verbal behavior? In particular, are even the behaviorally sound substitutes for meaning and analyticity, stimulus meaning and stimulus analyticity in the old days, are they still irreducible to physiological or physical matters, or may they give way in the fullness of time and the increase of knowledge to more precise sciences? Quine often speaks as if they may. In his essay, Mind and Verbal Dispositions, Quine distinguishes three levels of purported explanation of linguistic phenomena. And these are the mental level, the behavioral level, and the physiological level. The mental he dismisses as scarcely deserving the name explanation. But does this mean that transposing to the behavioral level must change the subject? Well, apparently not. Let us all recognize, Quine says, that the semantical study of language is worth pursuing with all the scruples of the natural scientist. We must study language as a system of dispositions to verbal behavior. End of that quote. Earlier in the same essay, he remarks on the, quote, conspicuous fact that language is a social enterprise which is keyed to intersubjectively observable objects in the external world, and suggests that this opens the door to, quote, getting on with a properly physicalistic account of language. End of quote. So the first step from the mental to dispositions to behavior doesn't change the subject, which is the semantic analysis of language. It just puts it in a way of being more scientific. Dispositions, for Quine, are physical states. Physiological states, when the disposition is what we usually call mental, like, let's say, being gullible. Physical, in the case of dispositions of physical objects, like the being soluble, solubility. And while Quine does not think anyone now knows how to give a physiological account of any behavioral disposition, he sometimes seems sure that there must be one. In fact, so far as this essay is concerned, there isn't much point in my distinguishing between physiology and a special domain of physics. So just to simplify things, I'll talk from here on as if physics were the whole of natural science. Of course, it's not. In The Roots of Reference, Quine writes, a disposition is, in my view, simply a physical trait, a configuration or mechanism. Dispositions to behavior are, then, physiological states or traits or mechanisms. In citing them dispositionally, we're singling them out by behavioral symptoms, behavioral tests. Usually, we're in no position to detail them in physiological terms. However, the deepest explanation, the physiological, would analyze these dispositions in explicit terms of nerve impulses and other anatomically and chemically identified organic processes. End of quote. The reasoning seems to be this. If an object has a disposition, this fact must depend on physical properties. So whatever can be explained by appeal to the disposition must be explicable in physical terms, whether or not we know how to give the relevant physical description. The case of solubility would at one time have illustrated the point, because, of course, serious chemistry, physics, doesn't need or use the concept of solubility, because it now can explain what happens on the basis of a finer-grained analysis. Quine also seems to hold that a fair account of the concept of evidence can ultimately be given in physical terms. For if we're an object, he says, quote, any realistic theory of evidence must be inseparable from the psychology of stimulus and response applied to sentences. And in Roots of Reference, he says, our liberated epistemologist ends up as an empirical psychologist. The learning process, he thinks, is accessible to empirical science. By exploring it, he writes, science can, in effect, explore the evidential relation. And a final few quotes. The attribution of a behavioral disposition, learned or unlearned, is a physiological hypothesis, however fragmentary. So, mental entities are unobjectionable if conceived as hypothetical physical mechanisms and posited with a view strictly to the systematizing of physical phenomena. Now, I find suggestions of several points of view, which to me would be different, in these passages. The theme of the irreducibility of the mentalistic vocabulary, when combined with the thesis that there could be a serious, that is, physiological or physical, account of the evidential relation and other mental concepts, is consistent only with giving up our present talk of propositional attitudes in favor of a vocabulary consistent with the rest of natural science. The claim that dispositions to verbal behavior are physical configurations suggests that far from being irreducible to the physical vocabulary, a sensible reduction is in the offing. Now, I think that at one time, at least, Quine was uncertain of the relation between the mental and the physical vocabularies, but in more recent writings, he's settled for the view that talk of beliefs, desires, action, and meanings is not reducible to a more scientific vocabulary, but that its usefulness for everyday descriptions and explanations can't be denied. The relation between the mental and the physical, which Quine now seems to accept, is what I have called anomalous monism, the position that says there are no strictly law-like correlations, between phenomena when they're classified as mental and phenomena classified as physical, though mental entities are identical, taken one by one, with physical entities. In other words, there's a single ontology, but more than one way of describing and explaining the items in the ontology, in many ways a Spinozistic outlook on the relationship between the mental and the physical. There are several reasons for the irreducibility of the mental to the physical, that is, conceptual irreducibility. One reason, appreciated by Quine, is the normative element in interpretation introduced by the necessity of appealing to charity in matching the sentences of others to our own. Such matching forces us to weigh the relative plausibilities of different deviations from coherence and truth, by our own lights, of course. Nothing in physics corresponds to the way in which this feature of the mental shapes its categories. Another reason, perhaps easier to grasp, though perhaps less important, lies in the irreducibly causal character of mental concepts. Let me give a non-mental example first. The state of being sunburned, my favorite example, is necessarily a state that's caused by the action of the sun. No completed physics would make use of the concept of sunburn, not only because part of the explanation of being sunburned is already built into the characterization of the state, but also because two states of the skin could be in every intrinsic way identical, and yet one be a case of sunburn and the other not. The propositional attitudes, the semantics of spoken words, and behavior as we normally understand it, are all like this. They're like the concept of being sunburned. The reason, both in the case of the attitudes and in the case of semantics, is the same. What our words mean or what our thoughts are about is partly determined by their history. The truth conditions of my sentence, the moon is gibbous, or of my belief that the moon is gibbous, depend in part on the causal history of my relations to the moon. But it could happen that two people were in identical physical states, whatever that means exactly, defined in terms of what's within the skin, and yet one could be speaking or thinking of our moon and the other not. When it comes to explaining behavior as normally conceived, this feature of the propositional attitudes is a positive asset, for behavior thought of as actions is also an irreducibly causal concept. Actions are thought of merely as motions, but as motions that can be explained by the reasons that an agent has, his beliefs and desires. Thus, if I pay my bill by writing a check, it's necessarily the case that I wrote the check because I wanted to pay my bill and believed that by writing a check, I had a good chance of paying my bill. The rest of this, of course, is a fairly long story. The actions are individuated along the same lines as propositional attitudes. That's why the attitudes do as good a job as they do in explaining actions. But this way of individuating and picking out actions is not going to help create a science of behavior that might, in principle, become an identifiable province of physiology or physics. There have been, of course, numerous attempts to extract from the propositional attitudes a purely subjective or narrow content, not subject to the difficulty science introduced by externalism. If this could be done, it would remove a major obstacle to making psychology a science, leaving only the normative aspect of the mental to make trouble. The reason why someone like Jerry Fodor or Noam Chomsky wants to find a purely internal element or aspect of the propositional attitudes is obvious. It's only if mental properties are supervenient on the physical properties of the agent that there can be any hope of identifying the mental properties with physical properties, or finding law-like connections between the two. If mental properties are supervenient not only on the physical properties of the agent, but also on the physical properties of the world outside the agent, there can be no hope of discovering laws that predict and explain behavior solely on the basis of intrinsic features of the agent. Both Fodor and Chomsky have made clear that they think an internal variety of the intentional is essential to making psychology a serious study. For related reasons, Fodor has also rejected most forms of holism, at least so far as language is concerned. And he gives a number of reasons. We've been over this early on. He gives a number of reasons for believing this, but what seems to motivate the rejection is the conviction that unless the meanings of expressions can be tied in law-like ways to specific neural configurations, there's no hope for a serious account of linguistic phenomena. Such ties would, of course, rule out external. What I think is certain is that holism, externalism, and the normative feature of the mental stand or fall together. If these are features of the mental, and they stand in the way of a serious science of psychology, then Weil, Wittgenstein, and Quine in his more pessimistic mood are right. There can be no serious science or science of the mental. Now, I believe that the normative, holistic, and externalist elements in psychological concepts can't be eliminated without radically changing the subject. I don't want to argue for these points in this present paper because I've done so at length in the other talks I've been giving here. My interest here is rather to ask, what follows if I'm right? Pretty clearly, it does not follow without argument that there can't be a scientific psychology. Whether it follows depends on what you take the notion of science to entail and whether the features that I hold to characterize the mental stand in its way. What does follow is that psychology can't be reduced to physics or probably to any of the natural sciences. But unless we simply legislate science to be what can be reduced to physics, the failure of reduction should not in itself be taken to show that what cannot be reduced does not deserve to be called science. Since my own approach to the description, analysis in a rough sense, and explanation of thought, language, and action has on the one hand what I take to be some of the characteristics of a science, and has on the other hand come under attack by both Fodor and Chomsky as being radically unscientific, I plan to examine my theory, if that's the right word for it, to see how or whether it can be defended as science. And I'd better say right here, the outcome is uncertain because so much depends on how you rate things as being science or not. Once you give up the idea that physics is the only serious science. I think there's much to set physics apart from all the sciences because it dreams of a completely closed system in the sense that whatever can happen, which is described in physical terms, can be explained as well as any explanation can go by other things that are described in that same vocabulary. Nothing, so to speak, interferes from outside. But psychology, meteorology, geology, biology are all sciences which aren't closed sciences in the sense that the phenomena that are described in them, in those sciences, can't be predicted with certainty except on the assumption that nothing interferes from the outside. You can only predict the weather if you assume that the Earth is not going to be hit by a meteor. And the same goes for the theory of evolution and a whole lot of other of these special sciences. Nevertheless, these special sciences, one senses, can in essential respects be made part of physics if it weren't so inconvenient. I mean, if only we knew more, we wouldn't really need these special sciences at all. For example, let's say geology deals with the notion of an igneous rock. That's a causal concept. A rock, you can't necessarily, in fact you can in practice, You couldn't necessarily tell that a rock was igneous just by looking at it, by studying it with all your instruments, because to say it's igneous is to say that it got to be the way it is through a certain kind of history. That history may or may not be a correct account of how this particular kind of structure came about. But one sees that geology could get along without the notion of an igneous rock, at least in theory. I'm saying this just to say the sort of intrinsic irreducibility of psychological concepts. It is not obvious to me that applies to the concepts in some of the other natural sciences. Perhaps I just should say I'm uncertain about that, and it doesn't make much difference. One way to think of the moment when psychology came of age as an empirical science is with the work of Gustav Theodor Fechner, whose life spanned most of the 19th century. Wonderful old man, 1801 to 1887. Fechner began as a physicist. Then he drifted into chemistry, then physiology, then medicine, then metaphysics, and beyond, mysticism. Now, you'll notice that I don't mention psychology, but Fechner was interested in the relation between mind and body, or matter and spirit, as he thought of it, a philosophical problem. And he thought that to approach this interesting philosophical problem, he would look for quantitative laws that connect the mental and the physical. Weber had already suggested, before Fechner, that the smallest increase in the intensity of a physical magnitude required to produce a perceivable difference in sensation is not a fixed amount, but is proportional to the magnitude of the stimulus. That is, least noticeable differences. Least noticeable differences are not directly proportionate to equal intervals on a physical scale. As noises get louder and louder, least noticeable differences get further and further apart in terms of vibrations per second. This goes for loudness, and it goes for a lot of things. For example, your ability to discriminate between differences in frequencies at very high levels decreases. That's why you can stand listening to coloratura sopranos. They may be almost completely out of tune on those very high notes, but your ability to distinguish whether they're out of tune is reduced the higher up you go. Unfortunately, I can distinguish them, so I can't stand coloratura sopranos, but the same thing goes for violins playing in the very upper registers. You hardly can tell what note they're playing, and that's lucky because violinists hardly know what note they're playing when they get way up there at the very top. I'm trying to bring all of this home to you in various ways. Now, Fechner generalized this observation of Weber. The experienced intensity of a physical stimulus is equal to some constant times the log of the physical stimulus. Roughly, as a physical stimulus increases, say intensity of loudness or pitch in sound, equal increases in the magnitude of the physical stimulus will result in smaller and smaller increases in the felt sensation. The constant varies with the sense involved, whether it's loudness, other dimensions, whether it's loudness, pitch, brilliance of light, and so forth. This law can, of course, be tested, and it's approximately correct. The decibel scale of loudness is an informal example. Equal intervals on the decibel scale are more or less equal subjectively, but the ratio of two amounts of acoustical power is equal to 10 times the common logarithm of the power ratio. If you just go up one point on the decibel scale, that won't be much physically at the lower end, but as you get to the upper end of the scale, there are huge differences in the actual amount of power that's working on your eardrums. It's something like the Richter scale for earthquakes, same thing. I'm impressed with Fechner. I think he had a right idea. If scientific methods can be applied to the mental, it's by proposing a solid theory, asking how it can be tested and interpreted empirically. And it'll be a good theory if it more or less works out. Theories describe abstract structures. Their interpretations ask whether these structures can be discovered in the real world. Fechner's theory is relatively easy to interpret in some cases, which is perhaps not surprising given the neurological basis of sensory discrimination. Given what we now know about neurons, neural nets, and the processing of information, so-called, that takes place in the sense organs and the brain, we would expect to find quantitative laws relating sensory discrimination and the physical magnitudes of stimuli. But they're closely related scalings of perceived sensations, which are definitely surprising, at least to me. Let me give you an example. This has to do with the perception of differences in pitch, not the kind I was talking about a moment ago, which correlate discriminations of pitch with physical magnitudes. The Greeks knew that if you divide a vibrating string in half, each half sounds an octave above the full string, and two-thirds of the string produce a fifth above the full string. This is credited to Pythagoras. I don't know whether correct or not. But what is surprising is that, this is what's surprising, if you sound two notes some arbitrary distance apart and ask a subject to tune a third note to a perceived midpoint, not only do different hearers arrive at approximately the same pitch, but pitches so determined are related in such a way as to produce an interval scale. That is, numbers can be assigned to various pitches in a way that keeps track of the relations between intervals, not on the basis of physical magnitude, like string length or vibrations per second, but entirely on the basis of what is subjectively perceived. The theory that describes this fact has every right to be called a psychological theory, for it deals with nothing but the relations among psychological phenomena. Since this is a kind of interesting fact in itself, and is not unrelated to the kind of thing I've been doing, let me just tell you what this comes to. Think of this as a pitch scale from lower to upper, whatever. Give a subject two fixed pitches and another which he can vary by turning a knob, and tell him, please put the one you can adjust halfway in between the other two. All right, so he puts it somewhere or other. So we'll start giving numbers to these pitches arbitrarily. I mean, the first two are arbitrary, the third one is non-arbitrary, as it marks a fact about what the subject has said. Part of the reason that this is astonishing is only the following. It's amazing to me that people can do this, because if somebody asked me to do it, I wouldn't even know what I was doing. I mean, I ask myself, what does it mean to say this pitch is halfway between these other two? So it's an astonishing fact that not only do people answer this question, but they answer it the same way. I mean, almost. Nearly enough to make it a very interesting fact. But now, the real surprise and the really interesting thing comes next. To make it easy to think about, now give the person these two pitches and say, adjust this other one so that this one's halfway in between. So he puts it somewhere here. We'll call this four. All right? Let's do it once more. We'll call this five. Now, if this is a real scale, I mean, if it's a real interval scale, we can make a prediction. Make a prediction. So this is where it becomes a serious theory, right? Because it's not as though we're just simply deciding where to put these things. Let's see if there's some significance to this. Well, what's the prediction? The prediction is if you give the person 5 and 1 and ask him to put something in the middle, he either will or will not give you this pitch. If he does, that's a new piece of information which you predicted from your theory and what you've already observed. That's how theories work, right? I mean, you have a theory, you take in some evidence, and on the basis of the theory, you predict something new. And then you see whether it works out or not, and if it does, then so far, so good. Here we're not saying anything about physical magnitudes at all. Right, or we're just using the physical magnitudes to keep track of the pitches, but we're not the numbers that we give the physical scale are playing no role at all. So this is, in that sense, a purely psychological theory. It's a theory about sensation, and it is roughly true. It's roughly true. So it's a serious scientific prediction. Of course, propositional attitudes are not playing any role in this. So I'm just using this as an illustration of what it might be like, what it is like, actually, to have what I think anybody ought to call a serious theory. If it's not serious, it's only because you may have some doubts about what's going on when people answer the question, please put this halfway in between, because it isn't precise. That is, people don't do this exactly right, they just do it pretty much right. Now, in a way, I've already given good examples of scientific theory in the field of psychology. One in the form of a general law relating to perceived intensity of sensory stimuli to physically measured aspects of the stimuli, the other in the form of the fundamental measurement of perceived intervals of pitch. The reason one of these is properly called fundamental measurement and the other not is one of them uses a numerical scale that's already been established, the one that matches up the psychological responses to the physical magnitudes. That's derived measurement, not fundamental. But the kind of scale I've described here is fundamental measurement, because all you do is set up certain axioms on the relations that should be there, and then you can prove, given that those axioms are satisfied, that you can represent the situation in the numbers, and those numbers will be unique up to certain transformations. In this case, clearly what you have is an interval scale. Just like the one for values that decision theory deals with, or the kind that we have for Fahrenheit and centigrade temperature. But of course, these examples do not speak to the concerns of those who ask whether or in what way psychology can be scientific. What they're interested in is the description, prediction, and explanation of intentional actions and associated attitudes such as intention, belief, desire, and linguistic meaning. Well, now, since I've been describing for the last couple of weeks a theory that deals with some of these more interesting and difficult concepts, I'm going to sort of re-describe it very briefly and then ask in what respects it has the features of a scientific theory. The theory that I've been describing relates the concepts of belief, desire, and linguistic meaning. And since the theory treats belief in a quantified form, sometimes called subjective probability, and desire as measured on an interval scale, it includes what is sometimes called decision theory, emphasis suited to the explanation of intentions and intentional actions. Unlike traditional decision theory, in the form first given it explicitly by Ramsey, the theory I have in mind integrally includes a theory of meaning. So it can be called a unified theory of speech and action. I'll refer to this as the unified theory. I hope this isn't going in for isms. I don't think so. You know what the unified theory is. I just described it in some detail yesterday. The theory itself describes or defines an abstract structure. This structure has certain interesting and desirable properties, which it's possible to prove that it has. Thus, one can prove with respect to the part borrowed from decision theory, both a representation theorem and a uniqueness theorem, two of them actually, one for probabilities and one for values. The first says, in effect, that numbers can be assigned to beliefs and desires that preserve the quantitative constraints imposed by the theory. The qualitative constraints imposed by the theory. The second says the numbers assigned to measure probabilities constitute a ratio scale, and the numbers that track desires constitute an interval scale. This is adequate to yield unique predictions of intentional actions. The part of the theory that copes with linguistic meaning is, in effect, a modification of a Tarski-type theory of truth, and so is provably capable of supplying the truth conditions of all utterances of sentences in a language of which it treats. The final part of the theory joins decision theory and truth theory by a formal device which I described yesterday. The possibility of marrying the two theories depends on two things. The first is that decision theory shows how to extract both cardinal utilities and subjective probabilities from simple preferences. The second is that subjective probabilities, when taken as applied to sentences, are enough to yield a theory of meaning. There's thus a route, which is technically, as we saw, a little Byzantine, but intuitively clear in each of its steps, from simple choices to a detailed interpretation of words, desires, and beliefs. The possibility of such a theory rests on structures dictated by our concept of rationality. Both decision theory, as I have used it, and the version developed by Richard Jeffrey, and theories of truth, for example, depend in part on logic. Jeffrey's decision theory and Tarski's truth definition take an underlying logic for granted. These theories would be true only of perfect logicians. Beyond this, of course, there is the assumption of a rational distribution of probabilities over propositions and of a proportioning of degrees of belief in accord with the conditional probabilities. In other words, propositions are held true to the degree made rational by what one takes to be their evidential support. Thus, the entire structure of the theory depends on the standards and norms of rationality, a number of them. One is logic, one is what you get out of decision theory, that is a rational relationship between one's various desires. Some of it has to do with the relations between the truth conditions that one assigns to various sentences. So rationality, so to speak, runs through and through this theory. Now, these considerations cast doubt on the scientific pretensions of the unified theory. But before I entertain these doubts, let me dwell a bit more on the overall pattern. Like any scientific theory, we have a clear and precise formal structure with demonstrable merits. There are only a few undefined concepts, and these are extensional. The basic primitive concept is the three-place relation between an agent and two sentences, which holds when an agent would weakly prefer one sentence true to another. This relation is extensional in the technical sense that a statement that this relation holds of three appropriate objects, that is, an agent and two of his sentences, holds regardless of how those three objects are described. Yet if the observed pattern of such relations fits the terms of the theory, it's possible to infer the degrees of belief that the agent accords to his or her sentences, how much the agent would like those sentences to be true, and what the truth conditions, that is, meanings, of those sentences are. In other words, the theory, if true, of an agent would serve to interpret the thoughts and words of that agent. Now, even this claim, guarded as it is by that little clause, if true, needs plenty of defense. It's a question, for example, whether belief, evaluation, and meaning are enough to support interpretation without adding, say, intention or perception as further related but independent variables, not to mention the emotions. It's also by no means clear that a theory of truth is adequate to the interpretation of speech, even assuming a theory of truth could be made to cover all the idioms of a natural language. But important as these matters are, I'm planning to leave them aside so that I can get on with the question whether a theory more or less like the unified theory can be thought of as scientific. My conclusion so far is, from a purely formal point of view, it's a powerful theory. And so far as it corresponds to many of our intuitions concerning the nature of rationality, that is, the nature of minds, it's an attractive theory. It's when we attend to the empirical interpretation of the theory that questions and problems arise. Now, here I want to distinguish between the official story about how the theory can be interpreted and an unofficial account. Officially, it's essential to be able to show how the theory can be interpreted without appeal to evidence that assumes the individuation of the contents of any propositional attitude. One such form of evidence is, as I mentioned, protocols that specify an agent's preference that one sentence rather than another be true. Given enough such evidence, a picture can be built of the agent's beliefs, desires, and meanings. A finite account of such evidence can only confirm the theory. Of course, it can't prove that it's true. But this is what we'd expect. That's going to be the case with any scientific theory. Now, yesterday I gave you a brief outline of the official story, that is, how it leads from the kind of evidence available to an outcome where you can interpret the person's beliefs, desires, and meanings. So I won't go through that again. That's an official story because it assumes that everything is going to go right. The merit of the official story lies not in its plausibility as an account of how we actually set about understanding others, but rather it lies in the fact that it amounts to an informal proof of the adequacy of the theory to yield what is needed for interpretation of the basic propositional attitudes. Here I should just compare it with the official story of how Ramsey's decision theory yields sufficiently unique results to explain choice behavior on the basis of simple preferences. That is, one sees that one can take a first step which will tell you that for a certain person, a certain event has a subjective probability of one half. You then see that you can keep dividing probabilities in half over and over and over and over again, given the assumptions that are made explicit in the axiom system. One sees that having done this for any arbitrary event, one then sees how one can calculate the relative values of certain outcomes for a person and so forth. All of that has to be put in slightly different language to fit Jeffrey's system. Unofficially, one can admit that as living, working interpreters, we never have enough of the sort of evidence needed to follow the official route. And we always have a great deal of other sorts of evidence. We make endless assumptions, the other sorts of evidence. Well, we make endless assumptions about the people that we meet, about what they want,
what they have to mean by what they say, what they, why they act as they do. We come to any actual interpretive situation filled with information of this kind. Our skills as interpreters come into play mainly when one or another of these assumptions turns out to be false. And by then, we have much more than the poverty-stricken evidence that the unified theory depends on. But this is the way it ought to be. The point of the theory was not to describe how we actually interpret, but to speculate on what it is about thought and language that makes them interpretable. If we can tell a story, like the official story, about how it would be possible, we can conclude that the constraints that the theory places on the attitudes articulate some of their philosophically interesting features. Now, I've described the art of applying the formal theory to an actual individual in its most transparent form, with both interpreter and agent to be interpreted as outfitted with a material set of concepts and the linguistic aptitudes for expressing them. All that's lacking is in the situation that I'm imagining, is a shared language and prior knowledge of each other's attitudes. Since the theory and the official story of how it can be applied are already remote from actual practice, I suspect that the theory will throw only oblique light on the acquisition of a first language and still more oblique light on the origins of speech. The most that can be said is that if we agree that the pattern of attitudes is as the theory depicts it, one can perhaps see that a creature properly endowed by nature could acquire it in the company of others already possessed of thought and speech. And the theory may also prompt an interesting hypothesis or piece of guesswork about the origins of language, but that is as may be. I should emphasize how much belongs to the province of interpretation, of trying to give an empirical application to the formal theory. The intended application is to individuals, strictly speaking, individuals at a given time, since we can expect many of the values and beliefs of anyone to change swiftly as the world around them changes. The apparently quantitative ingredients, the measures of degree of desire and degree of belief, don't belong to the theory itself. Like any theory of measurement, the numbers simply make use of the theory without being part of it. We could, if we pleased, use the theory only to keep track of the relations between the attitudes and the relations of the attitudes to the world, that is, their semantics. But in the case of beliefs and evaluative attitudes, it's convenient to represent these relations in the numbers, as the representation theorems for decision theories prove that we can. Now, here a special feature of the unified theory emerges, one which may well excite suspicion. For what plays the role of the numbers when it comes to assigning contents to the words and attitudes of an agent? And here I am going back over things I've said, so this does amount to a kind of summary of some of the things I've been at. What's required is some potentially infinite supply of entities with a pattern or structure complex enough to provide a model for the attitudes. Given such a supply, we can then keep track of the identities of the attitudes and the truth conditions of sentences. As far as I can see, each of us has such a set of entities, namely the infinite set of his or her own sentences. And these are all we have at hand when it comes to understanding other people. It's obviously these we employ whenever we attribute a particular belief or desire, intention, or meaning to someone else. This is not to say that my sentences are the objects of your attitudes. I merely use my sentences to keep track of what you think and mean, or to say what you think and mean. The attitudes don't have objects in any psychological or epistemic sense. The attitudes are simply states, and no more require objects before the mind than sticks require numbers in order to have a certain length. Now, to return to the question with which I began, to what extent or in what ways is a theory like the unified theory scientific? Such a theory is not, I think it's clear, reducible to a science like physics or neurobiology. Its basic concepts can't be defined in the vocabulary of any physical science, and there are no precise bridging laws that firmly and reliably relate events or states described in one in the psychological vocabulary with events and states described in the vocabulary of the physical sciences. But it would be uninteresting to simply define science to be what can be reduced to physics. Now, are there other difficulties? Three features of the unified theory and other theories like it that have been thought to remove it from the domain of serious science are holism, externalism, and its normative properties. Well, as I said, the entire theory is built on the norms of rationality. It's these norms that suggested the theory and give it the structure it has. But this much is built into the formal axiomatizable parts of decision theory and truth theory, and they are as precise and clear as any formal theory in physics. However, norms or considerations of rationality also enter into the application of the theory to actual agents, at the stage where an interpreter assigns his own sentences to capture the contents of another's thoughts and utterances. The process necessarily involves deciding which pattern of assignments makes the other, the person we're trying to interpret, intelligible. Not intelligent, of course, just intelligible. And this is a matter of using one's own standards of rationality to calibrate the thoughts of others. In some ways, this is like fitting a curve to a set of points, which, of course, is done in the best of sciences when they're being empirically applied. But there's an additional element in the psychological case. In physics, there's a mind at work making as much sense as possible of a subject matter that is being treated as brainless. In the psychological case, there's a brain at each end. Norms are being employed as a standard of norms. The unified theory is holistic through and through. It's designed to assign contents to beliefs, utterances, and values simultaneously, because these basic attitudes are so interdependent, it would not be possible to determine them one at a time or even two at a time. Its treatment of each of these domains is also holistic. Sentences are interpreted in terms of their relations to other sentences, beliefs in terms of their relations to other beliefs, and so on. Such holism is characteristic of any science of measurement. Items owe their measure to their relations to other items. A meaning could no more be assigned to a single isolated sentence than a weight or location could be assigned to a single isolated object. The holism of the mental cannot then in itself be an obstacle to the scientific claims of a theory of the mental. Quite the reverse. The possibility of theory rests on holism. The truth conditions of a speaker's utterances determine and so depend in part on the logical relations of the sentence uttered to other sentences. In the case of observation sentences, the truth conditions can also depend on the causal history of the situations in which the sentence was learned and used. This is one form that externalism takes. Since perceptual externalism of this sort introduces an irreducibly causal element into the interpretation of the theory cannot hope to emulate physics, which has striven successfully to extrude all causal concepts from its laws. Externalism sets limits to how complete psychological explanation can be, since it introduces into the heart of the subject elements that no psychological theory can pretend to explain. On the other hand, this feature in itself makes psychological theory no less scientific than volcanology, biology, meteorology, or the theory of evolution. Both Fodor and Chomsky have criticized the unified theory and its interpretation, which I call radical interpretation. They've criticized both of them. Some of their criticisms seem to me to miss their mark. Both Fodor and Chomsky say that radical interpretation gives a completely wrong account both of how linguists study new languages and how children acquire a first language. Now, here they have understandably been misled by the age-old tendency of philosophers to discuss the theoretical question, how a linguist or child could learn an unknown or first language, as if it were a practical question about how they actually do it. I've often explained that radical interpretation doesn't attempt to provide useful hints to real linguists or to criticize their methods. Much less does it pretend an insight into the mysterious, to me, business of first language acquisition. Fodor and Chomsky are actually outraged that radical interpretation makes use of so much less information than is available to the informed and methodologically sophisticated linguist. This irritation is fed by the conviction that, in my view, the evidence on which I say radical interpretation could be based is, in fact, all that is legitimately available. Chomsky, in particular, thinks I ignore his discoveries, if they are those, about how much of the syntax of natural languages seems to be genetically programmed. I've argued, as I mentioned above, that it's one condition on the correctness of a theory of meaning that it be such that if an interpreter knew it to be true of a speaker, the interpreter could understand what the speaker said. Of course, I denied that interpreters generally have, or at least know that they have, such a theory. The theory is rather what the philosopher wants if he is to describe certain aspects of the interpreter's interpretive abilities. I then added, it does not add anything to this thesis to say that if a theory does correctly describe the competence of an interpreter, some mechanism in the interpreter must correspond to the theory. Now, in a recent essay, Chomsky quotes this remark of mine, and he comments that, quote, from the standpoint of the natural sciences, this comment is utterly wrong-headed, unquote. His subsequent discussion makes clear that what annoys him is that he thinks I'm denying that there would be any interest in knowing what the mechanism is. But of course, that's not my view at all, nor is this what I said. What I said was, and intended, what I said was and was intended as a tautology. If a pill puts you asleep, it adds nothing to say something about the pill had the power to put you to sleep. It would be vastly interesting to know more about the nature of the pill, which explained this. It would be vastly interesting to know more about the nature of our linguistic abilities and the mechanisms underlying them. Who would deny it? If I have any doubts, they concern only the philosophical conclusions that Chomsky and some of his followers have drawn from their results. Now, Chomsky has accused me, and more particularly Quine, of supposing that all we know about language must be based on a certain kind of behavioristic evidence. Quine has spoken for himself on this matter, but I would certainly deny the accusation, and as far as I can see, there's no reason why Quine shouldn't. If we want to know everything about language, its acquisition and uses, there are no a priori limits on what evidence may be relevant. But I do share with Quine the conviction that our understanding of what speakers mean by what they say is based, directly or indirectly, on what we can learn or pick out from perceiving what they do. No matter how much grammar we come equipped with from the cradle, we must learn what words mean. We're not born with English or Hebrew or Mandarin, and this we only learn from being around other speakers. The behaviorism I speak of is, of course, not reductive in nature. I don't expect any basic intentional predicates to be defined in terms of non-intentional terms. The point is simply one about the general character of the evidence on which one has to base or ought to base any theory of meaning. And we learned from Quine yesterday, he also thinks that we can't give explicit definitions things like prompted assent in physical terms. The criticisms Fodor and Chomsky have leveled at philosophers seem to me largely well, not entirely, based on their having read into those philosophers views that those philosophers simply don't hold. I've tried to point out some instances. But there's also a failure to appreciate a difference in fundamental aims and interests. Chomsky apparently sees me as trying to understand and explain the same phenomena that he is, and therefore as proposing competing hypotheses. This seems to me to be altogether wrong. I want to know what it is about propositional thought, beliefs, desires, intentions, and speech, which makes them intelligible to others. This is a question about the nature of thought and meaning which can't be answered by discovering neural mechanisms, studying the evolution of the brain, or finding evidence that explains the incredible ease and rapidity with which we come to have a first language. Even if we were all born speaking English or Polish, it would be a question how we understood others, and what determine and what it is that determines the cognitive contents of their sentences. I don't care whether we call some of these projects scientific and withhold the term from others. I do care, however, about the limitations of the study of the attitudes that I've been discussing, just as in another context I'm interested in the limitations of Chomsky's or Fodor's work. What are the most obvious shortcomings of the unified theory of thought and speech, at least from my point of view? Well, first and foremost, there's the striking fact that the formal theory, as opposed to features of its empirical application, says nothing at all about inconsistencies. It not only postulates perfect logic and a consistent and rational pattern of beliefs and desires, but it assumes rationality in the treatment of what we take to be evidence. Inconsistencies and failures of reasoning power must be accommodated by injecting large doses of what I've called, Quine has called, charity in fitting the theory to actual agents. Perhaps all straightforward irrationality shows up as inconsistency. But clearly not all inconsistency is what we normally call irrationality. The formal theory just leaves no room for irrationality, and therefore is powerless to explain it. Any explanations of irrationality that we care to offer have to work against the unified theory, not with it. The unified theory, as I've described it, is static. It says nothing about the forms of rationality that deal with the incorporation of new information into a going system of thought. However, this is an area in which there is hope. Much work has been done by Jeffrey himself, Isaac Levi, and a number of other people on making decision theory dynamic, that is, discussing how a rational agent would adjust his beliefs and desires given new evidence. And in fact, if you think about it, the failure of the unified theory to incorporate anything like that is really a very serious matter, because it is quite explicitly changes in one's beliefs and desires that one uses to determine meanings. So this is not a superficial comment on something that basic that's lacking. It's a very deep one. Of course, this has to do with the interpretation of the theory, not the beauty of the formal structure. Finally, and perhaps most significantly, the interpretation of the formal theory does not rest entirely on ordinary intersubjective evidence. In measuring physical magnitudes, we can use the numbers to keep track of the properties of events and objects as publicly observed. The relevant properties of the numbers can also be agreed to by all concerned. But things are different when one mind tries to understand another. People are as publicly observable as anything else in nature. But the entities we use to construct a picture of someone else's thoughts must be our own sentences as understood by us or other entities with the same structure and characteristics. The meanings of our sentences are indeed dependent on their relations to the world that they're about and our linguistic interactions with others. But there's no escape from the fact that we cannot check up on the objective credentials of the measure we're using as we can check up on our understanding of the numbers. We can't check up on it because to do so would mean comparing notes with others, and to do this is to make basic use of our own norms once more. Now, whether the features of a psychological theory that I've been rehearsing, especially the last one, show that psychology is so different from a theory of the natural sciences as not to deserve to be called a science, I don't know, and in a sense, I don't care. What I'm sure is that such a theory, though it is as genuine a theory as any, is not in competition with any natural science. Thank you.
That I learned about Watson from my good psychology professor in college, and it was just, I've learned from Skinner's autobiography that it was just about the same time that he got onto Watson as a result of a reference to Watson in something of Bertrand Russell's. I think it may have been Our Knowledge of the External World. And as for language, my interest in historical linguistics had antedated my my encounter with Watson's writings, and I think that was true equally of Skinner. And so the result was that in 1933, when Skinner and I, both of us PhDs of one or more years standing, met with these two interests already well embedded and shared, and became fast friends.
Well, I'm sorry to have lost an anecdote I've been telling for years. I can still tell it. Yes. Let me try another. I talked at the very beginning of these lectures about how many of Quine's students and grand students and great grand students and so forth were present here. I didn't mention the fact that Quine and I have a common teacher, and that's Alfred North Whitehead. And furthermore, both of us came across Whitehead when we were undergraduates, because Quine got started in some of his interests anyway, with Principia Mathematica. And in fact, that's, I think I've got this right, part of the reason he went to Harvard as a graduate student was that Whitehead was there. That's more or less the end of what Quine learned from Whitehead. I took Quine's undergraduate course and graduate seminar in my sophomore year at Harvard, and that was the last year he taught, the last year he lectured there. And I became a student of his in the sense that I could talk more or less the way one the language goes in process and reality. And Whitehead befriended me, and for years I used to talk with him. And I've always said, and I still believe, this set me back in my philosophical development by at least 3 years, maybe more than that, because I thought I understood all that stuff. And it wasn't until many, many years later that I turned back to process and reality and other of Whitehead's late writings and realized I didn't understand them at all. So either I had understood them and forgot, or more likely, in my opinion, never did really understand them. So Whitehead had quite different influences on Quine and me, but he did happen to be
teacher in some sense for both of us. Is that right?
That's absolutely right.
Oh, good. I got so one true and one false.
Well, you had another comedy teacher, C.I. Lewis.
Absolutely. And Lewis certainly had a big influence on me, both in teaching me something, whatever it is I ever knew about Kant, but also Mind and the World Order, seems to me, as it does to Bert Grubin, to be a wonderful book. Extremely impressive, clear piece of work expressed in a way that makes it pleasant and exciting to read. Underappreciated these days, but I think one of these days it'll come back again. It's a good book for students, and indeed for anybody. Terrible man, though. Well, in a way, what could be more rewarding? Perhaps we shouldn't try our luck, or I shouldn't try my luck. Let's say, or let me say, how much I have learned from these sessions, and I'm not just saying it to be polite. I really have gotten, I appreciate certain problems which I either didn't see at all or hadn't quite taken seriously enough. Some of them are really quite basic and I really just have to go home and think about them. In a few cases, because of the questions and discussion, I thought of answers to things that have been puzzling me for a long time and which wouldn't have occurred to me if it hadn't been for these discussions and these questions. So it's certainly been rewarding for me in every way. Also just the general friendly, helpful atmosphere in which it has all proceeded seems to me a model for philosophical discussion. Thank you.
Thank you very much. It was an extremely nice and interesting series of lectures. I think that it was not just a personal period, but it was also an intellectual experience, and it was having all of you here again, to have here Professor Quine, and to have here again Professor Davidson, and all of you, that was not just an intellectual experience, it was intellectually a luxury. Right. It's luxury. Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you. All right. We have decided, well, there is a poster of Jesus for all of you. We think that we can perhaps like to have this as a the name is Pamperet. P-E-R-E-T. But since she knows, probably the best would be that she leads the group.
Maybe if you'd like to
the group. And then I'm going to pick up Marjorie. Fred. That's Little Peter. That's Little Peter.
Little Peter.
Little Peter. Well. That's it. It's not far away from here. It's not far away from here. But you will live.